What Goes Up is brought to you by SEI. Successful wealth managers know that opportunities are everywhere, but they don't count for much unless they can be identified and acted on. Learn how SEI can turn your operational infrastructure into a competitive advantage at seic.com/IMS.
Strap on your parachute. It's time for What Goes Up with Sarah Ponczek and Mike Regan.
Hello, and welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Ponczek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the markets team.
This week on the show, you could say the tone of markets has changed. All of a sudden, real yields are rising along with the dollar as inflation expectations fall, triggering selling in the likes of gold, for example. Cracks have begun to show in the credit markets and in the stock market. It's economically sensitive areas that have once again turned losers. Is this just a blip, or is this possibly something more?
And speaking of something more, we, of course, will close out the episode with our tradition, the craziest thing I saw in markets this week. Sarah, I got to say, the craziest thing I saw in markets this week, it's actually the most disgusting thing I've seen in markets this week, too. I'm going to give you a little tease at that.
Yeah, do we have to wait to the end of the show to find out what this most disgusting thing is, Mike? Keeping us all on our toes?
You do. Brace yourself, because it's nasty. It's crazy and it's nasty.
All right, well, I'm bracing myself.
It's interesting. And if you saw anything crazy in markets or even disgusting in markets that you want to share with us, give us a call on the Bloomberg podcast hotline. 646-324-3490, and leave us a voicemail and maybe we'll play it on the show. Also, you can tweet to us at podcasts and let us know what you think of the show, or if you've seen something crazy, we'd love to hear from you. Sarah, I'm excited for this week's guest. Do you know why? You must know me well enough to know why.
My only guess would be, is he also from Philly, Mike?
No, well, close enough. He's a Jersey guy. He's a Jersey guy like me. I'm from Philly, but I've kind of converted to full Jersey guy by now. I've defected.
Of course you have.
They've won me over in the Garden State. Yeah. It's all the Italian food won me over, I think.
That's fair enough. Over the cheesesteak.
But yeah. It's all about the stomach. But glad to have him on the show. First time on What Goes Up. His name is Larry Pitkowski. He is the co-managing partner at Goodhaven Capital Management in good old Millburn, New Jersey. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Oh, great. So, Larry, I was checking out the Goodhaven Fund before the show. One thing that popped out at me, I love to look at sort of the asset allocation, and at least as of the end of August, equity exposure was about 74%, cash and government securities making up the rest, about a quarter of the fund. So as Sarah will tell you, I'm about to launch a 12-part question based on that.
As he usually does.
I'm ready.
As I usually do.
I'll leave it at three parts.
Say, yeah, take notes on this question. Now, but to me, so that seems like... And correct me if I'm wrong, but historically, is that sort of a low equity exposure for your fund? And, you know, depending on if the answer is yes, I'm curious, does it have something to do with this sort of frothy valuations we've seen over the summer, the market getting up in some cases, depending on what index, what sector you're looking at, almost back to dot-com style valuations? And if that is a low equity exposure, anything in this correction getting you ready to sort of up that equity exposure or what? I'm just curious how you're thinking about that non-equity portion of the fund.
You know, Mike, at Goodhaven, the amount of cash and cash equivalents we've got is normally a byproduct of finding more or less things to do. Where, you know, I don't manage the portfolio to some target cash levels. However, you know, you make a fair point. During periods where there's more stress and more bargains, cash levels will normally come down, often sometimes dramatically. And when there's less to do, cash levels will build. I would say the current cash level we've got, which as of, you know, recently is, you know, kind of sitting around, let's say high teens, is, you know, kind of probably on average to what we've had over the last bunch of years. But it's interesting in the spring, during the height of the market swoon, you know, March of 2020, we put about 40% of our then cash to work as there were despite the unbelievable uncertainty and the unpredictability and something nobody had ever seen as far as in, you know, an economy that had partially shut down, we did put a lot of cash to work in high quality things that I think are already turning out to be very good buys. And I would say that's how we look to behave. We look to behave opportunistically when there are lots of things to do. However, I wouldn't ever say that I'm sitting around every day, you know, making some kind of market prediction by having a little bit more or a little less cash. I don't know anybody who can do that. I certainly can't do it. But you make a very good point. It is often a byproduct of finding more or less to do and flows of money.
You'd have to be a psychic in order to be able to time that, really, especially the way markets have been lately, Larry. I was looking through your holdings as well, and I noticed that Barrick Gold is one of your top holdings. And as I kind of mentioned off the bat of the show, that lately, although we had seen this unbelievable run, at least in the price of spot gold over the past couple of months, that since waned, as we've seen inflation expectations come off, as it looks like we might not get a fiscal package from Congress. I wonder, is your holding of Barrick Gold at all tied to an outlook on growth, an outlook on inflation, or is there a different reason that you're actually interested?
Barrick Gold, it's a very interesting story. We made it a big holding when John Thornton, the current executive chairman of the board, came in and really started to clean up what had been a prior mess under old management, where they made an acquisition of a copper company with no due diligence and they overlevered themselves. And I'm primarily a business analyst, okay? I'm a securities analyst, I'm a business analyst, I'm a stock picker, and I'm a risk manager. Lastly are macroeconomic thoughts. So Barrick has been an important holding for us for a couple of years. And I never minded having the optionality of the exposure to gold, which is an alternative currency for all intensive purposes, as part of the thesis, as long as the majority of the thesis, which was the business, the valuation we paid the management team, was really the predominant reason to be in it. Now, when Barrick merged with Rheingold and Mark Bristow took over, the story got even better, okay, a couple of years ago, because Rheingold was the best managed gold miner, I think, in the world, and had unbelievable statistics for creating shareholder value. So as I was looking at the portfolio somewhat recently, what you've seen since the pandemic as far as money printing, increases in debt, and that goes, you know, in the US and around the world, it does lead one to be even happier to have some exposure and a material exposure to an alternative currency. The thing to keep in mind about these types of things, you know, after the 08 financial crisis, the number of people who were thoughtful and, you know, really had a strong view that we were about to enter a period of hyperinflation, and the stuff done during the great financial crisis to create certain bailouts was going to create a weaker dollar and runaway inflation, all kinds of problems. There were strong views about that. And instead, over the next 9 years, we had deflation and a stronger dollar. So you got to be very careful, because these are very difficult things. But from where I sit today, Barrick is we have an enormous unrealized gain in it. The thesis and how they're running the company keeps getting better. And it's hard not to look at what's happening as far as printing of money, deficits, stimulus, you know, negative real interest rates. The Federal Reserve is very clear that they want to keep rates low for a long, long time, and feel that it's nice to have something in the portfolio that has some potential exposure positively to all those things, but wrapped around what appears to be a well-run company. And it's not an easy business to be in. You know, mining is not, there's not an enormous number of companies in that business that have created a lot of long-term value. But Mark Bristow has done it at Rheingold. We're forever grateful for John Thornton for having come in and really righted the ship. And so that's how we think about that position and how it became where it is today.
Yeah, it's funny. I always think back on that. There was that famous open letter to the Fed that like 30, 40 investors and fund managers signed, warning of, you know, Zimbabwe-like inflation from quantitative easing. And
I guess the lesson there, Larry, is never sign your name to a letter like that, predicting dire outcomes.
The lesson is that trying to put together a portfolio using macroeconomic predictions is really, really hard. There's a couple of people in the world that have done it well, you know, the Soros and Druckenmiller. But I think a lot of investors, you should really try to steer clear of having that be the thing that is the driving force in how you're picking stocks for your portfolio, because it's very, very hard and very few people get that kind of stuff right. So and again, the interesting thing also about Barrick is, you know, it's become over the last few months, a lot of people have become interested in the sector, and it's interesting. And of course, with, you know, gold at $1,900, the cash flow is a lot more than when gold is at $1,300. But, you know, when we made it a bigger holding a couple of years ago, you know, nobody was calling me up saying, oh, that's really interesting, you made that a bigger holding. I was getting more, you know, polite, like, what the heck are you thinking? And, you know, what are you doing? And, you know, and things that I wouldn't repeat on your very high class, podcast.
So high class, Larry. I'm sure people are writing in like, why gold? Why not Apple? But yeah, I'm so flattered that you called us high class. I think Mike's a bit surprised.
I think he might be listening to the wrong podcast.
Probably.
I think he dialed into the wrong
right.
Zoom.
Uh-oh, I gotta go.
No, but...
Along with alpha-generating skills, perseverance and operational strength are essential factors for growth in the asset management industry. At SEI's Investment Manager Services Division, they know that in an industry often paralyzed with complexity, disruptive forces also create opportunities. If you see potential in change, SEI's industry specialists will help optimize their integrated end-to-end global investment operating platform to position your asset management business for success. Helping you grow and compete is what they do best. Go to SEIC.com/IMS to see how SEI can turn the possible into reality.
Now, but Larry, you make a great point. I mean, I think a lot of investors struggle to wear that micro and macro cap at the same time. And Sarah and I appreciate being able to talk individual names like this. I don't know how many guests we have on who are like, I'm not allowed to talk about individual stocks. So it's refreshing for us. So I want to talk about the biggest holding, at least as of the end of last month, Berkshire Hathaway. Maybe a few listeners have heard of that company, Larry, kind of an obscure one.
Just
there.
Just a few.
But are you a Buffettologist, I assume? And I guess the big question I have is, you know, eventually we're going to get this passing of the reins from Buffett to his successor. Is that a buying opportunity or a selling opportunity, do you think?
I've owned Berkshire on and off in different sizes for many decades. And the interesting thing is that, which I wrote about in my last shareholder letter, is that, you know, I find that many people who are, you know, supposed to be, you know, professional investors have very strange ways of thinking about Berkshire. Some, you know, there's some form of worship without really, you know, doing any real, you know, deep analytical work and thinking about it as a business. And some just, you know, there's never ending joy in a kind of a gotcha kind of moment of finding anything that Berkshire does wrong with just a like, oh, I told you, they're not so good. So, you know, neither of those two extremes are logical ways to think if you're trying to make logical decisions with money. So from my perspective, when I looked at them, by the way, in March, April of 2020, during the height of the market collapse, I basically doubled our exposure to Berkshire. So, you know, what was I thinking? I was thinking, well, you know, we have an economy that is shut down to a great extent. Here's a company that has $140 billion of cash. Here's a company that has a long history of great shareholder returns. Their main business is property and casualty insurance in a couple different sectors. My feeling was that property and casualty insurance, the market for pricing and terms is improving claims from the, and they would be able to deal with the, you know, COVID-19 claims, and there's some noise around some of that. And the stock price was, I thought, selling at a very attractive price, really kind of approached book value. the optionality for them to put money to work in different rescue financing or transactions existed, though they may or may not do it. And I think it's unfortunately a certainty that at some point Mr. Buffett and Mr. Munger won't be, you know, calling the shots anymore. I think, and I have some knowledge, the bench at Berkshire is much more talented and deeper than I think people really give it credit for. And I think Berkshire, while 20 odd years ago was really, you know, a holding company with a securities portfolio, I think it's much more than that today. The magic of Berkshire is the generation of insurance float at no cost, which then can be invested and help to drive book value growth, and a couple of very large businesses, the railroad business, the utility business, the insurance business, and an investment portfolio that one has to make a judgment of. So when you put that all in the mix, I thought at the prices that were available in the spring, I thought these were really dirt cheap prices. And so we bought an enormous amount. And, you know, I think that it is playing out reasonably well. The negative on Berkshire, which is material, is just size. It's hard to move the needle. You know, it's $500 billion market cap, and they do something very clever and they make $1 billion. It doesn't really move the needle that much. But if you buy back more stock, or, you know, at some point you distribute more money, you know, that's a solvable problem. So one of the keys I found over all the years is just to try and be rational and not, you know, get caught up in too much emotional drama about how you think about any holding, you know. So at Berkshire, I may change my mind one day, but I thought it was a very good thing to increase our exposure to dramatically in the spring. And as it turns out, you know, a lot of the criticism lately of Berkshire had been, oh, you know, it's a lot of old economy assets. Well, meanwhile, you know, something like 40% of the portfolio is Apple, and they've been too inactive. Well, you know, shortly after all that criticism, they made a $10 billion deal from some, you know, natural gas distribution assets from Dominion. You know, so they've done plenty of other things over the last month or so. So, you know, and you had a board member, actually, Merrill Whitmer, who's a well-respected investor, is on the board, who bought, I think, $2 million worth of stock in the open market for herself and her family in the spring. So, you know, but again, we'll just try, you know, I'm ably assisted here in doing the analysis and running Good Haven on the portfolio side, you know, by Artie Kwok. And we'll just continue to, you know, crunch through the numbers and think about, you know, where the business or the company is headed over time.
Along with alpha-generating skills, perseverance and operational strength are essential factors for growth in the asset management industry. At SEI's Investment Manager Services Division, they know that in an industry often paralyzed with complexity, disruptive forces also create opportunities. If you see potential in change, SEI's industry specialists will help optimize their integrated end-to-end global investment operating platform to position your asset management business for success. Helping you grow and compete is what they do best. Go to seic.com/IMS to see how SEI can turn the possible into reality.
I kept thinking back during the turmoil in the spring. I kept thinking back to the financial crisis when they made those really well-timed investments with the preferred shares in some of the banks that were struggling back then. I was kind of expecting something like that this time. I wonder if it, you know, if it tells you anything. You know, Buffett calls it his elephant hunting gun, all that cash. You know, he, like you said, he's fired a few shots from it, but still kind of holding fire with all that cash through all of this. Does that tell you anything about perhaps how just uncertain and risky this environment is, where Buffett doesn't seem to be comfortable really writing a giant check for some distressed asset right now?
I think in the March and April timeframe, one of the things that I think got in the way of Berkshire potentially doing some rescue finance was the Fed coming in so fast and in such an extreme way into the credit markets, which I think allowed a lot of borrowers that were viable and interesting, but on somewhat shaky ground, to access the fixed income markets or the equity markets. And you saw the, you know, the number of underwritings done by across the investment banking spectrum. And I think, you know, if not for that massive Fed intervention, some of those companies would have been knocking on Berkshire's door, you know. But, you know, again, you know, they've not been. Thursday morning, Berkshire announced a deal with Scripps, which was a preferred with some warrants on very attractive terms, of smaller size, but a very typical Berkshire deal. And, you know, they did buy, you know, recently a slug of all the Japanese, the five or six major Japanese trading houses. And, you know, so, but they were less active at that period. And, you know, and again, I think there were a couple of reasons. And Mr. Buffett may very well, and deputies may have very well looked at, a shutdown economy and said, well, you know, let's tread gingerly a little bit. But I think the Fed intervention and the ability of companies to access traditional financing so quickly was very different than in the global financial crisis. That's not, you know, that process took months. You know, that, you right. know, Fed intervention right. and go for, you know, that, and it gave Berkshire an opportunity to, you know, put some capital to work. So.
It does feel as though, I mean, policy response, but everything this year has almost just happened at warp speed. You mentioned earlier on, though, Larry, how Berkshire is a really big company. So something has to happen to really move the needle. And I'm just going to make my way down the list and looking at the portfolio. And I see you also have Alphabet as another one of your top holdings, which is also a large company. And I'm also going to preface this by saying it's my turn now, Mike, to ask a 12-part question. But one, I want to ask you, I know... there's a lot of talk about how some people, when they think of value investing, they think about it in the wrong way, that some think of value investing and you're leaving out possible ways to value a company. I know, especially this year, a lot of people have brought up conversations about how to price the likes of intangible assets. And I just wonder how you work this into your thinking and your process when you're looking at companies to put in your portfolio and how Alphabet might fit into that that process as well.
By the way, Mike, I don't know how to tell you this, but that's my favorite question so far that Sarah just asked. So don't.
Thank you.
Don't take this the wrong way. You know, Sarah, you raise a really interesting point. And in my last shareholder letter, I attached a letter I had written in 1998 to then clients talking about how owning good businesses with high returns on capital that had some defensible mode of some sort, that were well managed. Quality is not inconsistent with value investing. And it's one of the things that I think is, here at Good Haven, as I took control of the firm recently, we needed to hearken back to a little bit more. Our history in owning Alphabet, for instance, purchases were mostly made after a bunch of years ago, after they had, shortly bought YouTube, and there was all kinds of noise, people saying, oh my God, you know, you paid whatever it was, $1.6 billion, $1.8 billion to YouTube. That's an insane valuation. And the company's a one trick pony, and, you know, paid search is peaking. And I think that you make a very good point, Sarah. I think, first of all, in the world of technology, for those of us that have been around a long time, one of the problems with investing in technology many years ago, okay, in my recent letter, I talk about how in 1982, if somebody had come to you and said, look, half the world, in 10 or 15 years is going to have a PC, you know, you want to put a big chunk of your net worth in the top three PC companies, and they were then Commodore, Tandy, and Wang. And if you would have done that, you would have lost a lot of money, right? It was a very hard business to see the future because it was changing so rapidly. However, if you looked at, you know, Alphabet 6, 7, 8 years ago, I think you would have seen something selling at a relatively attractive PE ratio, maybe not 8x earnings, maybe it was low teens or mid teens, and growing rapidly. And then you had to do some research and you had to say to yourself, okay, you know, the snowball of advertising budgets moving digital from non-digital, you know, where is it? Is it the ninth inning? Is it the second inning? Is it still growing? And how are they going to allocate capital? And what about these new things? They just bought YouTube. Is it sensible? And I think if one would have come to a sensible conclusion, I think the earnings in Alphabet's case, I think the earnings growth over the last 6 or 7 years has, you know, very much told the story of the underlying intrinsic value growth. I think, though, Sarah, your question raises a kind of an interesting point, was some of the differences in today and looking at a company like an Alphabet or an Apple. First of all, these companies, they take very little capital to run. I mean, many, many years ago, if you looked at General Motors or Bethlehem Steel or U.S. Steel, you know, it takes an enormous amount of actual physical, you know, plant equipment to and inventory to make these things run. Digital companies are different, and often, you know, there's less capital spending, but there's more run through the income statement. So you make a very good point that one has to consider such things as intangible assets and returns on capital and think about it all differently. I don't think that one wants to wade into starting to veer into, you know, metrics. You know, 1999, 2000 was all about how many eyeballs. I don't think that that's necessary of a way to think about valuation to have found some of the big tech companies, whether it's Alphabet or Facebook, attractive investments at different points over the last six, seven, or eight years. And I think it is important for value people, you know, to not forget that owning quality is perfectly consistent with value. The other thing that I think you're raising a good question is, if you own something of such good quality and it grows very well, you should be very loath to sell it just because the valuation is no longer dirt cheap. That's a second issue. But anyway, that's...
All right. I think we've gotten most of the top holdings, but one more before we get to the crazy things. Jefferies Financial Group. Tell us what you like about them.
Well, Jefferies reported earnings Thursday morning that were, you know, stellar. I could think of a few more even more positive words. Jefferies is a investment bank that came together through the merger of Old Jefferies and Leucadia. Rich Handler runs the place very well and owns an enormous amount of stock. The price, even after, you know, some recent gains, is probably, let's call it $18. I think tangible book value is $26. They are improving the return on equity. They are good at what they do. They're good at protecting book value. And in a world where bargains are not easy to find, I think something at that valuation, with that kind of talented management team, and again, you know, the earnings that you have seen, you know, both Thursday morning and in the recent couple of quarters, I think should tell you that they're on the right track.
You know, I always expected them to get rolled up by another bank. I wonder what the story is there. Maybe Handler just wants no part of that now.
I don't know. That's something you'll have to ask him. But, you know, I think from as an owner, I think it, as long as they continue to, you know, to build value, I think everything will, you know, the rest of it will take care of them. Will take care of itself. So.
All right. Fair enough, Sarah. We'll have to get Rich Handler on the show and explain it all to us sometime.
That'll be the next ask.
All right, it's that time. It's the time you've been waiting for. The craziest things we saw in markets this week.
Stand clear of the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
I'm going to go first, Sarah.
Yeah, because we've been waiting on our toes just because we want to hear what's gross that you have to tell us, Mike. Been waiting with bated breath.
As you can probably guess, I am a big fan of the alternative asset marketplace. And Sarah, it does not get any more alternative than this. I should give a plug to the terminal. If you have a Bloomberg terminal, type in NI space auction go, and you can follow along with the crazy things I find on there, because there's always something crazy being auctioned in the alternative asset space. And this is really alternative, Sarah. So
NI auction, though, you just gave up your sweet sauce.
I did. I know. And I have other tricks, though. So I throw the bone to people a little bit. As you probably know, there's a robust market for Michael Jackson memorabilia. You know, if you could get your hands on one of his old gloves or one of those loafers he moonwalked in, worth a fortune. This one shocked me, though. Someone is auctioning off. I should preface this. As you may remember, Michael Jackson had some problems with drug abuse towards the end there. And he was, right before he died, he was actually hooked up to an IV that would administer these painkiller drugs to him
It's a tragic story too. I'm kind of feeling bad. I even brought this up. Anyway,
it better be worth it.
Someone is auctioning off the final IV bag that he was hooked up to, and it comes complete with Michael Jackson's blood stains on the IV bag. I'm ashamed of myself. I can see our producer. She's like, she's covering her face. She's so ashamed of this crazy thing.
Okay, this is ridiculous, but I can't say I'm not curious for what this is going for.
Well, I was going to get to that. Let's play Price is Right. Now, and here's where the value comes in, I think, is if it is stained with his blood, I mean, you could maybe clone Michael Jackson. I'm just throwing that out there to the buyers out there. If some crazy mad scientist looking guy in a lab coat and wild hair shows up at this auction, I think we know where this is going.
I think that's the only way this should be able to go.
Let's play Price is Right, Sarah. What would you expect to bid for the winning bid to be for this item?
I'm lost. I don't even have anything to base this off of. I have no single comparison. But I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to guess $250K.
Whoa.
Why not?
I've got a lousy poker face on that one, Larry. So Larry, you can probably read my poker face there, and let's hear your prices right.
I don't know. I kind of liked the range of Sarah's price.
Yeah, $250. So the guys, it's some memorabilia merchant in Las Vegas who is in charge of this auction. They're saying they're hoping to get $2,500. I agree that that's low. $2,500. I don't know about $250,000. Unless you can actually clone Michael Jackson, then what price is
look,
that?
Look, at least I got the 25 base right. But I as soon as I said it, I knew I likely overshot. But
Sarah, but I took your lead on this one, Sarah.
Nothing to compare this to.
Well, you know, maybe they're lowballing here, and someone as enthusiastic of a collector as Sarah Ponczek will show up and bid $250,000.
I am a big Michael Jackson music fan, I must say.
There you go. So I apologize to anyone who's grossed out by that. I'm kind of grossed out myself about that one, but I wanted to show you how strange and how crazy the alternative asset space can go. Sarah, you talk to a lot of allocation experts. Maybe you can throw that in there. What sort of allocation should you have to celebrity IV bags?
Yeah, the next time I'm on the phone with a multi-asset strategist or investor, I'm going to suggest this. Say, you know what, instead of adding to your gold bets in your portfolio, you should run NI Auction on the terminal and see what you can get. Better bang for your buck.
Look, Larry's fund has a decent amount of cash in it. I'm just going to throw it out there. But... All right, Sarah, what do you got? Can you top that?
I don't think I can top it, to be honest, but let's go ahead with it anyways. So we've been talking a lot about trying to figure out the right way to value a company and knowing a company that you owned. Well, this week, there was just a bit of a funny, I guess I'm going to call it a kerfuffle, didn't really make sense. So at the beginning of the week, there were these reports that Amazon was partnering with Echelon Fitness to make a $500 fitness bike. And it immediately tanked Peloton's stock price because everyone knows that when Amazon enters your space, not the best thing for you as a company. Well, the next day, it didn't take very long. Amazon came out and denied that they were in partnership for this bike at all. They told Echelon to stop selling the bike. Supposedly, this was being called the X Prime bike. And an Amazon spokeswoman had to come out and basically say this bike wasn't related to Amazon, and Echelon then blamed the incident on quote-unquote miscommunication. And it really makes me think, like, I wonder if this was just a ploy for them to get their name out there, for people to be thinking, oh, I think Echelon has made this really cheap bike in partnership with Amazon, even if it's not true. But, you know, the price of name recognition is pretty high.
That's a pretty good one. Has anyone contacted that woman from the Peloton commercials that everyone was outraged about?
Not that I know of, at least.
Maybe she'll sign on with. She needs to sign on with Echelon. That would
she should.
That would seal the deal for me. That's a pretty good one, Sarah. I got to admit, that's a good one. It's no Michael Jackson IV bag, but I tip my hat to you on that one. Larry, how about you? Have you seen anything crazy in markets this week?
Well, you know, who could come up with anything that says, you know, off the charts as the Michael Jackson IV bag, Mike? I mean, it's, you know, I mean, look,
I'm a professional at this, Larry. I, you know.
Mike's tapping himself on the back.
I am. That's true.
Look, the wonderful thing about the markets, it's fascinated me for, you know, forever and ever, is, you know, there's always, you know, dramatic swings and volatility and opportunities on either end. And, you know, it never, you know, human nature never ceases to amaze one. You know, when everything's doing well, everybody's, you know, feeling optimistic. And when there are bargains and things to do, people are, you know, hiding under the desk. You know, as a smart friend of mine said, you can have good headlines or cheap stock prices. You just can't have them at the same time. So that continues. So, you know, human emotion will always, you don't have to wait very long to see those extremes in the markets of today. You don't have to wait very long to see those extremes. And, you know, I'm just waking up every day trying to, you know, use those extremes to the advantage of me and my, you know, fellow investors. So, you know, I don't have anything as esoteric as as your thing, but I'll continue to enjoy watching how emotions swing around and just try and make the most sense of it.
Yeah, and you know, make a good point. I feel like the 180 in sentiment at the beginning of September is just remarkable, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's unbelievable. Don't forget where, you know, where markets were in March and April and what the outlook was,
yeah.
And putting cash to work there was, was not easy, but you know, it's, for those of us who have been around for a long time, that was a very unusual period, but you know, I've seen such periods before and they're never exactly the same. And, but I think, you know, it's never more important to keep one's wits about one when there's such extreme volatility. And I think it served us well at, Good Haven, where, you know, where ranking is improving dramatically versus our peers. And we're happy to be, continuing to try and, build the track record.
You know, all this talk about emotion makes me realize, I think the reason I guessed 250K, Mike, is because I think we've all just been embedded in this world in which the term has been stocks only go up and we've seen asset prices rise. And I just think that anything these days, especially an IV bag of Michael Jackson's blood, could go for a high price. Why not?
Yep. It's a frothy market, Sarah. I can see where you overvalued the IV bag. Well, we'll see. We'll see. Maybe you'll win. Maybe when the final auction is amount is known, you'll have won the prices right on this. We'll have to check back out, because I do think they were lowballing. You know, look, when you're auctioning something and you're talking to the press, you should highball it, right? You're like, oh, we're hoping to get $5 million for this. I don't know why they lowballed it at 2,500.
Yeah, this isn't anyway. Over. This isn't over. I think we'll have to circle back to this once it's
auctioned. Makes me wonder if Sarah's actually the seller. Makes me wonder if Sarah's actually the seller of the item and she's trying to get the price up.
Jokes
Sarah,
on you.
Are you secretly the seller? Right. All right. Was I not supposed to mention
well,
that?
Well, Larry clearly unveiled the mystery of the show. I am the seller, but
right.
Unfortunately, right. We are going to have to leave it there. Larry Pitkowski, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek, Mike is at Reaganonymous, and you can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. Also, thank you to Charlie Pellett of Bloomberg Radio and the voice of the New York City subway system. What Goes Up is produced by Jordan Gaspore. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
What Goes Up is brought to you by SEI. Since its founding over 50 years ago, SEI has provided asset managers, family offices, and private banks with flexible outsourcing solutions with robust investment infrastructure platforms. Learn more at seic.com/IMS.